So why are kokako such an important bird to understand what's going on in the ecosystem, right?
Yeah, because they are quite poor flyers, they rely heavily, so all their food needs to come from their territory. So a territory can be as I think on average is around 4 hectares, would be the average territory for a kokako. So they need all their food to be present within that 4 hectares, you know. And what we're seeing now is because of the way our forests are being modified by introduced browsers like deer, goats, wallaby, and I'll put pigs in there as well. We are losing a lot of those species from the forest composition that kokako rely on. For me, there's no better indicator of forest health than looking at the success of a bird that cannot move outside that forest.
Hello, kia ora, and welcome to the People Helping Nature podcast, brought to you by Conservation Amplified. Our show features the stories of people who are helping nature to bring more awareness to this amazing space. I'm Callum, the co-founder of Conservation Amplified, and in today's episode, we're joined by Wayne O'Keefe, who wears a lot of hats in the conservation space, and he's currently involved with a number of projects. And today we're going to be talking about what does a healthy ecosystem actually look like in New Zealand? And exploring that from different angles. So welcome aboard, Wayne, and glad to have you on the show.
Kia ora, Callum. Nice to be here.
Would you like to tell us a little bit about what you're involved in and how you got involved in the conservation space?
So going back about 25 years ago, that's when I first arrived on these fine shores. I was born and raised in South Wales in the United Kingdom. My partner is a Kiwi. We met overseas 27, 28 years ago, and then I came here to New Zealand about 25 years ago. For about the last 20, 21 years, I've been fortunate enough now to work in the conservation space, and specifically the community conservation space. So, helping community groups and conservation groups, landowners, essentially to achieve their conservation outcomes. That's enabled me to develop a broad range of interests. I think if I was to plants are my passion, native plants. And the forest is my happy place. I guess you would call me a forest ecologist. So currently, for a day job, I work for an organization called Bay Conservation Alliance here in the Bay of Plenty. It's a charitable trust set up to support community conservation groups. So currently, we have about 30 member groups, and it's growing that we work with, and we provide support with a varying number of tasks, you know, from admin support right through to strategic planning, technical advice, toxin permits, wildlife permits, and that sort of thing. So it's essentially taking the pressure off what are largely volunteer groups and helping them. As part of my role with Bay Conservation, I've been seconded into a project called KEEP that I'm leading, and that is the Kōkako Ecosystem Expansion Program, which is an ambitious multi-generational project to connect discrete populations of kokako in the Bay of Plenty, which is hugely exciting. It's a stakeholder group. I'm also a trustee with Tane's Tree Trust, and I also do some volunteer work as well for the Whakatane Kiwi Trust.
Wow, so you've kind of got your a lot of hats you're wearing. But why community conservation, Wayne? What makes communities particularly important in this space?
Essentially, without communities, there is no conservation in Aotearoa. It's largely driven by community conservation groups. Those are driven largely by volunteers. You know, so I think anyone who works in conservation will find themselves alongside community groups and conservation groups because they are at the forefront of it. A number of the groups I work with have been gone for 20 plus years. So you can imagine the institutional knowledge that exists within these groups. People who have given up countless hours, the number of projects where, you know, it's not unusual for them to rack up 6 to 10,000 hours of volunteer time each year, which is quite phenomenal. So I really do think that without this conservation effort from the volunteer sector, yeah, we'd be in trouble.
I couldn't agree more, to be honest. I started my conservation volunteering as an adult with a group called Ōtāne Wānuku Kiwi Trust, which is on the outskirts of Tauranga, and they have a remnant forest that's original native forest and a bunch of kiwi and kokako, which is part of the Keep project with them. We'll talk about a bit later. But in seeing that and then being involved in a range of other groups around the Bay of Plenty, some of which Wayne's involved in, I've just found that the people who help conservation through community and volunteer efforts have to be some of the most dedicated individuals I've ever met in my life. You know, people who will give up a lot of their career and a lot of their free time and a lot of their cash as well, so that they can spend all this time in the forest and to help species and to help ecosystems. Bay Conservation Alliance has been a really big win for the Bay of Plenty as far as community conservation goes. But I guess it'd be really good to understand what void or what gap does BCA fill? How does it help community conservation to thrive?
So BCA is able to provide the network for starters. So by having 30 member groups, we're actually able to create a network amongst those 30 member groups. So my experience over the years in working in the community conservation space is that because these people are largely volunteers, you know, they're giving up their time on a Saturday or Sunday or doing the work, generally their focus tends to be very much on their actual project that they're working on. They don't have the luxury of space to actually start to look outwardly, you know, and start to think about building those connections with neighboring projects. So BCA, they can actually provide a conduit between various projects, you know, to help build those connections. So I think that's a key role that Bay Conservation plays. Also as well, there is a lot of admin involved in running a volunteer group, especially if you're a charitable trust. You know, so BCA can and does help quite a lot in lightening that burden on volunteers. You know, we can help them even find funding as well. Because, you know, as you know, funding is fundamental to conservation. Without that, and for most groups, it is a constant quest for funding. You know, you cannot take your foot off the gas pedal. As soon as you've heard about a successful grant application, you're looking for the next one. You know, so that in itself takes up a lot of time. So since BCA's inception, we've managed to secure just over $2 million of funding for our member groups. And that in itself is quite huge.
That's an awesome feat. I didn't realize you had secured that much overall. Just to summarize, so there are ecosystems around New Zealand that need our help, and volunteers, people in the community, are those putting their hands up to help and giving their time. Volunteers who care about the nature in their backyard come together into community groups where they will help to restore the forest or restore the ecosystem in particular. And these are small volunteer-driven groups that don't have the time and resources to do a lot of the admin functions. So without a group like BCA, would it be fair to say that these volunteer groups would really struggle to get done what they do, and therefore bringing them together and uniting them enables communities to focus on getting the results that matter?
I think it can definitely help. You know, I wouldn't be arrogant enough to think that without BCA, these groups would fall over. They would still exist. Not as effective and as not efficient, and potentially just be a little bit more burden on their time as well. Something, a niche that BCA occupies as well, is sort of being the conduit between the conservation groups and local government and national government departments as well. So for example, like the regional council, we've got a very good working relationship with our regional council here, and we help to support their care groups. We've got a good relationship with Department of Conservation, and we also help to support the groups that, you know, is working on public conservation land as well. So the role of BCA also provides a very valuable conduit between those groups and entities like the council and DOC.
Right, yeah.
Who aren't necessarily resourced. Yeah.
That just makes it easier if you're dealing with one main group and, of course, all the smaller groups, but less back and forth communication and repeated stuff. And how does Keep fit in? So you've got community groups like Atani Wanuku and Kaharoa, and then where does Keep fit into that picture of protecting our ecosystems?
Okay, so getting back to Keep's inception, which was, I believe, in 2017, it came about as a recommendation from the Kōkako Recovery Group, which is an overarching technical advice team, if you like, led by DOC, driving Kōkako conservation in the country. And they recommended to Kaharoa Kōkako Trust that in order for them to develop a sustainable population of kōkako. They need to have X number of birds over X number of area. So they don't have the area. So the kōkako recovery groups say you need about 2,000 hectares of protected forest to qualify as a sustainable habitat for kōkako. And Kaharoa, from memory, is just under 1,000 hectares. So an Ōtaniwanuku is exactly the same as well. They have a kōkako population there, but they don't reach the 2,000 hectares either. So both reserves, both forest remnants, are 6 kilometers apart. So it made sense that they would start talking to each other and planning of how to create a corridor, if you like, between those two populations, which would then hopefully allow genetic flow between those two populations to make them more sustainable. So KEEP started as a stakeholder forum, essentially. So lots of like-minded, interested parties around the table, such as Kaharoa Kōkako Trust or Taniwanuku Kiwi Trust. Forest and Bird were instrumental. We have forestry companies, regional council, district council, Department of Conservation, Kiritu National Trust, landowners, catchment groups.
Lots of people, yeah.
Yeah, there's lots of people, and that's a beautiful thing about it. You've got a very diverse range of people around the table, all wanting the common goal, essentially, and that's to have, you know, sustainable populations of kōkako in the Bay of Plenty. So that's how it was, its inception. KEEP is also a member group of BCA, and that's how I got involved with them when I joined BCA a few years ago. I was lucky enough to have KEEP fall under my wing, if you like, as one of the groups I look after. So I was quite blown away by what I saw, just going to some of the initial meetings, just to have so many people around the table with a shared passion. And I thought to myself, look, I think we can take this further. Long story short, we developed a proposal. We took it to a funder here in the Bay, one of our main funders, and they're really, really strong on conservation. Essentially, our funding application was successful. So what that meant then is we have been funded for 3 years to stand KEEP up as a project to become operational. So my role is as project manager, essentially, is to stand the project up.
Awesome. So yep. To make sure that we've got this clear, there's community groups like Ōtaniwanuku and Kaharoa, yep, which are forest remnants, so it used to be all continuous forest cover. Yep. Farms were developed and other developments over the years. And now these population of our kōkako native bird, the blue-wattled crow, is limited because it can't fly over these areas of farmland. And so whilst there are communities helping, KEEP's goal is to actually connect with every stakeholder involved to then connect up these remnants so that you have connected forests all over the Bay of Plenty. Is that right?
Yep. I mean, that's the end game. You know, potentially we are 100 years away from that end game. Stage one is connectivity between Ōtaniwanuku and Kaharoa, and it is 6 kilometers across farmland. We're quite fortunate in that it's deeply incised country up where we are. And so fortunately, a lot of the gorges are still forested, you know, so we've got a good base to start from. And just getting back to what you said earlier on, it's valuable context as to why we're doing this. Kōkako are very poor flyers. You know, they were known as the bush squirrel, essentially. And they are essentially the canary in the coal mine, you know, for forest health. They're not able to fly across that 6 kilometer gap. They're such poor flyers that arguably they can only make it a few hundred meters across open land. And generally that has to be downhill as well. So they can't fly uphill. They'll just soar downhill. Interesting talking to some of the farmers up in the area that we work in, and one of them in particular refers to them as fence hoppers. So he remembers as a boy seeing them hop across the fences, you know. So we're thinking, how can fences become corridors as well?
That's funny. When we went to Tiritiri Matangi Island a few years ago, I saw the kōkako in abundance for the first time there. And seeing them hop around, I said that they're like kangaroos with wings. Definitely their wings aren't their strongest point.
No, they're not. They are quite rounded, their wings, you know. So they were probably, I don't know whether they are heading towards flightlessness, you know, give a few thousand generations. Maybe that's where they'll end up.
So why are kōkako such an important bird to understand what's going on in the ecosystem, right?
Yeah, because Because they are quite poor flyers, they rely heavily. So all their food needs to come from their territory. So a territory can be as, I think on average, around 4 hectares would be the average territory for a kōkako. So they need all their food to be present within that 4 hectares. And what we are seeing now is because of the way our forests are being modified by introduced browsers like deer, goats, wallaby, and I'll put pigs in there as well. We are losing a lot of those species from the forest composition that kōkako rely on. There's no better indicator of forest health than looking at the success of a bird that cannot move outside that forest. You take, for example, something like a tui or a kereru or koromako. They have the ability to fly in between forest remnants. So if this food is scarce in one forest remnant, they can go across another forest remnant, and they can also use the urban environment as well. There's an awful lot of food in the urban environment for our native birds. But kōkako cannot make that move, so they're entirely dependent on what's within their territory.
Right. So protecting the kōkako is not just good for the species. It's actually good for understanding the health of the entire forest, because if you take like the hardest eater, the hardest one to please in the forest, everything else is going to benefit from it.
Yeah, that's a good way to look at it, Callum. Fundamentally, in conservation, we like to hang our hat on a keystone species. I think that's just the way we are wired as humans. Yeah. It's cute. It's got eyes. We're in there. But obviously, we're not naive enough to not understand that whatever we do to benefit kōkako is going to be benefiting, our biodiversity as a whole.
So what does a healthy ecosystem look like?
To me? Bearing in mind that, we have lots of ecosystems around the country, my speciality, if you like, is forest ecosystems. So to me, it is having all the plants present that should be there, fundamentally. Our temperate forests, we have five tiers to our forest, from the canopy through understory, all the way through to ground cover.
So what are those stories? What are those areas of the forest?
So we have the canopy, the understory, the lianes, the shrub layer, and the ground cover. So essentially we should have, plants occupying every niche throughout the forest. So if you were to take a column within a forest, you should have plants occupying each of those niches. But you yourself, quite often you go into forest, and because it's been browsed for so long, all you end up with is canopy, maybe some sub-canopy. But generally, once you get down to the shrub layer and the ground cover layer, all you're left with are the unpalatable species. So by unpalatable species, we mean species that your browsers don't favor. So we have some species like kawakawa, horopito, crown fern, etc. If you're seeing an abundance of those species in a forest and not much else, that it's being browsed to the point where they've removed all those palatable species.
So when you go into a forest and you've got this big canopy, but there's not much between that and the ground, that's when you're looking at trouble. Is that right?
Yep. I mean, beech forest is quite exceptional there because beech forest is quite sparse anyway by its very nature.
Okay, so aside from beech forest.
Yep. It's in trouble essentially because trees fall over, right? Trees die, and in a healthy ecosystem, there's always something to replace that tree that's fallen over. But if you've got nothing between the canopy and the ground and a tree falls over, there's nothing to replace it. So what we're heading towards there is something called canopy collapse, which we'll see all around the world. It's not a unique problem to New Zealand. It's something you can witness in many parts of the world.
And when canopies collapse, one of the first problems I can see is that you create open space for light to get in, which dries out the forest floor, which creates less room for the seed bank to thrive and plants to pop back out. And then also it creates opportunities for invasive species like pines and gorses and others to drop in there. What other problems are faced by canopy collapse if you don't have an understory coming through?
Well, eventually no forest.
No forest.
Eventually. I mean, that's the end game there to canopy collapses. You have no forest. And in a in a healthy environment, it's okay to have trees fall over, you know, because you will have that light well. Light wells are generally very, very fertile places, if you like, because there's an enormous amount of seed just waiting in the soil, just waiting for that light well to appear. So a lot of those species are opportunistic. So once that light well appears and the sun hits the ground, there's this massive race for the canopy. So you get all your pioneering species, if you like, jostling. Unfortunately, a lot of those pioneering species, the ones that fill that gap, are palatable species. You know, so it's not uncommon to go into a forest that is heavily browsed, and you see a light well. There's nothing growing in that light well. Conversely, if you go into a forest where they've got very good browser control or there aren't any browsers, if you look for a light well, you will see, you know, a very rich array of native plants. You will get some weeds in there as well. I mean, that's inevitable. But generally, you will get a really good selection of native plants popping up in those light wells. So again, for me, that's a really good indicator, you know, how healthy the forest is. I go looking for a light well. If I'm seeing seedlings competing in that light well, for me, it's a good sign. If I'm not seeing seedlings competing in that light well, it's a bit of a worry.
Yeah, I guess light wells are a natural part of the environment. Trees die, they fall over. It's all about what comes up afterwards. And not having the understory, not having that initial layer that can replace the dead canopy is a major red flag. At a surface level, it's obvious. There's browsing ungulates like deer will come along and eat the understory. Mm. And then that understory results in this issue. But let's take a look at this from some different angles. So I guess, what about invertebrates? When you have a healthy ecosystem, or on the other hand, when you don't have a healthy ecosystem, what does our invertebrate community look like in the forest?
Yeah, look, I'm no invert expert by any stretch of the imagination, but anecdotally, so by opening up a forest through browsing will encourage drying out of the interior of that forest, because if you can imagine those shrub layers, the ground cover layers are actually protecting the interior of the forest from winds. So with winds comes drying out. Invertebrates do not like that, you know, so invertebrates are quite sensitive to the particular environment they grow in as well. It's the same for plants, you know. If you look at a lot of our plants, like the filmy ferns, the mosses, the liverworts, and a lot of the lichens as well, they require quite particular conditions. And when the forest dries out, those conditions are no longer there for them. So they are dying out as well. So anecdotally, again, talking to some people, you know, observation is that they start to see a decrease in species like filmy ferns. So, you know, we don't really notice, because they're not sort of front and center in our minds, things like, you know, the small plants, the filmy ferns and the mosses, we don't really notice their decline, but it is happening through the forest drying out. And of course, then the knock-on effect is the impact that will have on invertebrates, the impact that will have on birds. You know, so it's those knock-on effects, essentially. Our forests are not meant to be dry.
And what other ways would you classify a healthy forest?
A good array of plants. The plants that are growing, they are meant to be growing. They're palatable species.
So by that, what do you mean by the right plants that are meant to be growing there?
So palatable species, essentially. Right. So those are the plants that ordinarily deer and wallabies and goats, etc., would remove from the ecosystem. So if I walk into a forest and I'm seeing palatable species, then for me that's a good sign. And with that, if you've got a good understory layer, then you start to notice things like humidity, you know, and how it's cooler in the forest as well. And that all adds to it. The invertebrates is another good one. Bird life, obviously, that goes without say. Running water, you know, it's...
Right. Well, of course.
I mean, mustn't forget that. In forest that's heavily browsed, what can happen is that the streams will not run for as long as they can within forest that has a healthy ecosystem, you know, because when the rain falls, it just washes straight off the land into the streams. It's not being retained in the soil by the roots of the trees, because they're missing. We have to view it holistically, and often we don't.
Yeah, we look for a prescription to the symptom of the day rather than what's the cause.
Yeah, and there is no prescription, you know.
So browsing deer, browsing ungulates, pigs ripping up the roots of the ground, the introduced species that are eating the plants are a major problem. This doesn't take away from the predators in New Zealand, the stoats, the rats, the ferrets that are eating our birds. So we've established that having plant browsing animals in the forest, like deer, like possums, like pigs as well, as like goats, is a major problem, and that it prevents the succession and all the ecosystem benefits that you get from having a healthy ecosystem. That's not to take away from the challenges posed by other introduced animals like stoats and rats and ferrets, but for our browsers, does that mean that we should get rid of all of them and that removing them all from our forest is the answer? Should we just go to that extreme of we need to get rid of all introduced animals?
In short, no. Maybe in my ideal world, yes, but in reality, I'm a pragmatist, and I recognize that these animals, they've been here for quite a long time now. We brought them here for various reasons. One of those reasons is for protein, for meat, for sport, recreational hunt. And as a result, a lot of these animals have become inextricably linked with our identity as Kiwis, So I recognize that. So it would be impractical to expect a country free of browsers. I mean, you just wouldn't want to do that, for the reasons I just mentioned. However, I still think that we can be better at managing populations, can we get to a point where we have certain areas of forest where we categorically say, okay, no deer here, this needs to be intact forest, and then we allow hunting in other parts, in other forested areas as well. So I think there is a balance to strike, but how we reach that balance, that's the challenging part, I think, and those are the tough conversations we have to have as a country.
Yeah, and would you say that we're very far off the balance right now? Is it a few minor changes and we're there and our forests can thrive, or are there major changes needed to get there?
I think in some areas, major changes. I think fundamentally as well is we do need a little bit of a mind shift and develop a deeper understanding of the damage that deer are doing. Some people mightn't care, and there's nothing we can do about that. But I know a lot of people will care, so it's just having the ability to open their eyes, if you like, to the damage that deer are doing.
Mm. There's quite a lot of good work being done by communities of hunters as far as trapping and, keeping an eye on when do we hunt to make sure that we're keeping the population down.
Yep. I think hunters will have and will continue to play a fundamental role in this space, and I think the government's recognized that. And so the government is getting alongside hunting groups, to work with them to develop workable strategies. I think DOC invested quite a bit of money just a couple of years ago into that space, specifically resourcing to look at how DOC can work a bit more closely with hunting groups and hunting clubs. Come up with something that's going to be workable for everyone.
Which comes back to what we were talking about at the start of this chat, was the role of communities in conservation. Definitely an idealist at heart, and the fact that you're a pragmatist at heart makes for a really interesting look at this conversation. In an ideal world, I would click my fingers and we wouldn't have any of the issues with invasive species, but that's not reality. The answer you had was a workable solution. In terms of how do we confront the predator, the invasive pest issue, and how do we work so that nature ultimately gets the best outcome? Community is an important element. We've established that. Having some level of ungulates is probably realistic to expect. How do we get to working in a way that we can have these outcomes? What are the key changes that need to take place in your view?
Oh, crikey, that's a big question, Callum.
all the big questions today.
Yeah, it's a biggie. So I think, you know, starting with the community space, you know, I think everything has to stem from the community, you know, whether you're from European descent or whether you're from Maori descent, you know, it needs to stem from the community, you know, to have the community driving it. But in order for the community to drive it, I think the community first has to understand the issues. So I think, you know, something that we're doing within Keep is try to raise awareness with the landowners in the catchment groups that we're working with, you know, as to, you know, potentially the deer are doing damage. Well, they are. They're doing damage to your forest. They're not just doing damage to your forest. They're damaging your bottom line as a farmer, you know, because you might only see one or two out during the day, but you can guarantee they'll be part of a bigger mob, you know, and they're eating an awful lot of grass. You know, so potentially there's ways there to communicate with the farmer community around the damage they do to the bottom line. I think fundamentally finding suitable reasoning for a wide section of society, because for many, you know, biodiversity gains is simply not enough. It's not enough of a hook. So something I've learned, you know, over the years of working with landowners in that conservation space is some people will do what we consider to be the right thing, and it's done not for biodiversity gains. It's done for another reason. The biodiversity gain is a spin-off. You know, I can give you an example there of working with this farmer who's fenced off a number of remnants on his farm. Now, I wouldn't call him a greenie. He wouldn't call himself a greenie. He's pretty old school. He likes trees. But for him, the driving element for him to fence off the remnants is because he'd have happier stock. So he was farming in a particularly windy part of the country. And what he observed is that, you know, the cows obviously on a windy day would go to the sheltered side of the bush. But the wind was whistling through the bush because it wasn't fenced off. So what he did was he fenced off these remnants, and the response inside was tremendous because there aren't any deer in the immediate environment. The regeneration within that remnant was phenomenal, to a point within, you know, a few years, you couldn't see your hand in front of your face. Wow. So what that was able to do was to slow the wind down across the farm, you know, and he talks of the benefits to his cows from doing that, of lower vet bills, drinking less water, producing more milk. You know, again, it's anecdotal stuff.
But we made it a priority.
But the fact that he did the right thing because it was good for his cows, you know, so I think a big part of conservation is the psychology element as well, and it's finding the hook. You know, because doing it just for biodiversity's sake is not good enough for a lot of people. There has to be another reason.
To summarize, all the actions in the world can do good stuff, but before any of that, we need to have a fundamental awareness as New Zealand, as communities, as people, of the needs for conservation and the challenges, which I hope this podcast helps with, by the way. And secondly, we need to make it a priority, and we can't expect that do good because nature will benefit is a message that can scale. You know, for some people it works, but if we want this to be a lasting change, it has to be what's in it for me. Here's why you should do what nature needs.
I think it's fundamental there, you know, and also we need a well-resourced department of conservation. They've just been kneecapped in recent years. I deal with people on the front line, the dock rangers, you know, and they're some of the most passionate people you'll ever come across, you know, but they've been hamstrung by the system, so they're not able to do what they want to be doing. So I think, you know, fundamentally, we need a well-resourced Department of Conservation. You know, I think we also need the funding model to change as well. You know, I think the funding model is no longer fit for purpose.
How so? What needs to change about the funding model?
Oh, I think we need to better reward, or initially incentivize and reward people for doing the right thing. So for example, you know, a farmer who wants to do the right thing, he wants to protect his streams, you know, but the cost of fencing alone, the cost of replanting, can often mean it's prohibitive, you know. And if you're fortunate enough to have a proactive regional council in your area, you can get support for that. But in areas where you don't have a proactive, you know, regional council and incentivization schemes, that landowner is faced with a huge cost burden. You know, it's not just a one-off cost. It's an ongoing liability for the farm, because there's fences to maintain, there's plantings to maintain. You know, so I think as a model, we need to recognize that behavior and reward it somehow.
Yeah, and there's been some research into the likes of biodiversity credits as a way to reward actions that help nature. I don't think at the time of this recording in July 2024, I don't think we've hit the answer on how do we properly value, incentivize conservation and incentivize biodiversity improvement, but we're definitely making good strides in that direction.
I think we are having the conversation as a country, which is good. You know, so the government realizes that there needs to be incentivization and reward. But you're right, how that model is going to look, I think that's the sticking point. I was involved in a working group last year that fed into a paper that went to government, and everyone around the table could agree we need some sort of biodiversity credit system. But we always come up against a brick wall when we would talk about, well, how would you standardize the reward, if you like? You know, with the ETS, it's quite simple, you know, it's units of carbon, you know, but how can you put something like that into the biodiversity space?
I mean, it's really difficult.
It's so complex, man. It's very, very difficult to measure biodiversity uplift. It's incredibly difficult, incredibly expensive, you know. Yep. So how do we reward, you know? So it's a tricky one. And then you've got all this old growth native forest around the country, you know, which is currently excluded from the emissions trading scheme because it's considered too old, you know. Could the emissions trading scheme be a reimagined that we can, you know, bring in old growth forest? Because that potentially then could be a good way of incentivizing and rewarding Maori groups as well, you know, because often in their settlement packages, they were given back an awful lot of forested land, which arguably to them doesn't have a great deal of value aside from, you know, that cultural value. There's no intrinsic value in it for them, you know. So if we can get into a space where they can get rewarded, you know, for doing the right thing, i.e. conservation, it could make them less likely to want to plant something like pine, you know, which is happening a lot. So I think we need to really rethink our the mechanisms that we use to fund conservation here. We look to businesses, you know, a bit more. How can we give them better confidence in investing in biodiversity and in conservation? You know, I know we've talked about this at length, Callum. There is a disconnect between sort of business, industry, and conservation. It's a gap that needs to be bridged somehow.
Yeah, definitely. Mm-hmm. And I can see the perspective from both sides. I have my family firmly in both camps, and it's definitely a lot of work needs to go into place there with providing businesses with the assurances that what they're investing in is actually having a measurable effect. And from the conservation space, it's professionalizing it a bit more. It's taking it from a local community that wants to do stuff because they care and turning it into something that can actually sustain lasting partnerships with different types of organizations like corporates. So we've covered quite a few things that need to happen to return our ecosystems to a healthier state, in particular looking at how do we deal with the issues around forest plant succession. People need to be more aware of it. We need to make it a priority, so financially incentivizing it for landowners and the stakeholders that actually make the calls. We need to give DOC proper resourcing to do their job well on a nationwide basis, and we need to incentivize the right actions so that if you do, you know, I guess that comes into the second point, but if you do take positive action like fencing off some old growth forest, that you get a financial reward, and that can work for landowners, for iwi groups, and for community. One thought I had a while back was, could we, if we did that, would that fund DOC by having, if old growth forest was paid for and so much of DOC's land is old growth forest, could that simply fund their you know, the cost of having rangers running that land?
Yeah, potentially. I heard a statistic the other day from Nicola Tocchi, CEO of Forest and Bird. She said that DOC's budget is less than that of Christchurch City Council, which is, yeah, just spells it out, eh?
It's crazy. Even if you look at some of the more ambitious projects, it's going to cost $80 million, as of last time I checked, to remove pests from Auckland Island, the Mokahoka project. And that sounds like a lot of money, but you'd pay triple that to build a sports stadium and you wouldn't bat an eyelid at it. Yet it's a gigantic sum to remove 40, 50,000 hectares worth of predators from a globally significant space. So the problem is that when we talk about conservation and we talk about money in conservation, immediately our wallets seem to close as a public. I don't know what the answer is here, but that fundamentally needs to change. But I think really underpinning all of that is awareness and willingness to take action. And if you're not aware of what's going on, like all the awesome positive work people like you, Wayne, are doing, the willingness isn't there to really prioritize protecting nature, then all of these other conversations can't effectively take place until that underlying awareness is there.
I couldn't agree more. You know, I think awareness is key, essentially. A lot of people don't understand what we've got here, how special it is, you know, what 65 million years of isolation has done to our flora and fauna. We have an obligation, simple as that, we have an obligation, you know. It's on us, you know, and it's something I feel passionate about, essentially, is trying to engender and spread the word, if you like, the gospel, you know, of how special this country is. Because coming from the UK, right? You know, I come from the UK. It's a beautiful country. You know, it's got, you know, it's just steeped in history. You know, I can walk along a dry stone wall that's 3,000 years old, for goodness sake. I can sit next to a cathedral that's 1,500 years old, you know, but these are man-made structures from a natural perspective. Mm-hmm. It's all gone. You know, you really, really struggle to find virgin forest in the UK. You really struggle. So coming here and seeing what was here and how special and unique it is, and how we're in a position now where we can actually save a lot of it. You know? But to the average person, they don't know. If you don't know, you don't care. You know. So I think that awareness is going to be fundamental as we move forward, because it's part of our identity, right? You know, it is. Part of our identity as Kiwis.
You know? Yeah.
We talk about the silver fern, you know. So our identity is inextricably linked with nature.
I feel like we're riding nature's coattails a bit with our identity as Kiwis, as clean green Kiwis. I believed in this fully for most of my life. As a business owner and as a marketer for Kiwi businesses, we trade off that, you know, things are so clean in New Zealand, and as New Zealanders as a whole, we think of this as our identity, but we've lost more native species than any other country on the planet in the last 1,000 years. We have more endangered species than any other planet, I believe. We've lost 90% of our wetlands in the last 150 years. I think 99% of seabirds, I read a statistic somewhere. I can't quite remember the source right now, but the numbers are pretty sad. But our identity is so inextricably linked to, at a distance, our conservation. But the awareness of people was not there to have that conservation in place. And people come from all over the world for our nature, to travel here, to holiday here, to study here, to live, to bring their family here, to bring their kids up here. And so I think, yeah, it's just a conversation that needs to be brought into the spotlight a bit more, however that happens. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of stories, like the story of the kokako, and that signifies the health of the ecosystem if you have these indicator birds. There's the story of the underlying forest cover, the understory, and that coming through, which is important to have long-term forest health. There's the story of removing the predators that are eating our native birds. But these aren't, you know, there might be a little bit of lip service here and there that's talked about it, but I think these need to be a bigger part of our general everyday conversation if we value these wild spaces so much, so that we can actually put action and prioritize that. Because, you know, whether it's a company offering an ecologically friendly product, whether it's the government putting resources into conservation, or whether it's your local community having enough volunteers and enough donations to get by, that all relies on people asking for what they want. So I guess a few questions to wrap it up, Wayne. How can people practically help nature? What can they do on a day-to-day basis to do more for our biodiversity?
First and foremost, for me, it's become more aware. You know, if you become more aware, you start to care. If you start to care, that's where the actions come, you know. So it's easy to say, you know, I'll put a trap in a backyard or plant a tree, et cetera, et cetera. But for me, everything stems from awareness. From that awareness comes desire, comes wanting to do the right thing. So I think fundamentally it is that awareness. Be curious about your surroundings, you know, ask questions. On another level, you know, we've talked about the community conservation groups, you know, there are so many of them out there. So if someone did want to, you know, decided they wanted to do something in the conservation space, it's very, very easy to find out what care groups or conservation groups are acting in your area. And they can do a wide variety of tasks. Often they're killing stuff. Sometimes they're planting stuff. I've got one group that looks after a threatened plant collection. So you can actually find the group to match your interests as well, you know. And even as well, you know, you mustn't forget the well-being aspect of it as well. You know, we haven't touched on that. I think that's potentially a whole podcast there for you, Callum, on the wellness aspect of being in the Nahiri, working in conservation and seeing those positive benefits, man, you know. Because yeah. I can introduce you to farmers, you know, that arguably doing conservation activity on their farm has made the difference between life and death. It's as simple as that. It's as simple as that, you know. It is fundamental. So I think, you know, there's the opportunity for people to get out there and exercise as well. We down here in Whakatane, we have the Whakatane Kiwi Trust. We have over 90 kilometers of trap lines, around 40 to 50 volunteers that service those trap lines. A number of those people probably don't care about biodiversity, to be honest, but they do it for exercise, you know. So again, it comes back to, it doesn't really matter what the reasoning is, as long as they're doing it, you know. So again, if there's an opportunity there, get aligned with a local community group, you know, adopt a trap line, gets you out in the bush every couple of weeks, gets you in that good space. Yeah.
And you meet nice people too. I think.
Oh, look, man, you just be the salt of the earth, man, honestly. You know, but I guess it's the same in all aspects of society where you've got volunteers, they're volunteering for a reason, they are generally good people, eh? You know, so definitely. Be a right in conservation. Yeah, they're my tribe, eh? I step outside the conservation circle and I'm like a duck out of water, man.
Yeah. They're a good bunch.
Yeah.
I think the points you said about how can people help nature on a practical basis all come back to planting seeds, which is this topic of this podcast, is letting those seeds grow through to represent the forest canopy. And whether it's becoming more aware, whether it's getting into nature for whatever reason, it's about planting seeds that grow within you. For me personally, when I moved to the Bay of Plenty and early 2018, I joined Otani Wainuku Kiwi Trust as a volunteer because I felt like getting away from the office on the odd weekend, and because I wanted to explore a part of the forest that nobody else sees. Planted the seed in me that went on to do all these other environmental things and eventually meet my partner, Anna, who's co-host on here. And, you know, I didn't go in thinking, hey, this work in a community group is going to change my approach to and my outlook and my beliefs on stuff. It was just because I wanted to feel good, right? And so what does conservation mean to you?
What does conservation mean to me?
Throwing all the hard questions today.
It is quite a broad one. Conservation means to me, I think it stems from the people. That's a tough one to answer. What does conservation mean to me? Might need a bit of time to think on that one, Callum.
No pressure.
I mean, it's everything that we've talked about today, really, you know. It's about having that awareness. And I think knowing that we can make positive change, you know, that for me is key. I don't get wrapped up in national politics, international politics. It's not my gig. I come from a place of my sphere of influence, you know. Can I make positive change within my sphere of influence? And conservation enables that, you know. And just being able to empower other people, if you like, and enable them to reach their conservation goals. It could be something simple, you know, but putting one or two steps in place that enables them to achieve their conservation goals. So, you know, the species protection, obviously, forest protection, obviously, but I think what I've come to realize is conservation is about the people.
People helping nature.
Yep. People helping each other. You know, the social aspect, the supporting aspect.
The community of it, I guess you don't, it can sound like a buzzword until you actually get involved in it and you realize what it means.
Oh, yeah, absolutely, man. Yeah. Like, I'm fortunate enough to work with, you know, a number of community groups across the bay. And they just never cease to amaze me. They really don't.
And is there any particular community group you'd like to point listeners' attention to?
Probably all of them.
Find out more about your work.
Yeah, okay. So, I mean, if they wanted to, they could go and have a look at the KEEP website. So that's keep.org.nz.
K-E-E-P.
Yep, and we can put them in touch with sort of local Kukaku conservation groups if they like, or alternatively, if they went to the Bay Conservation Alliance website, they can see all the member groups that we work with. So that could give them a pretty good oversight as well as to what's happening in the Bay in terms of conservation outcomes. And excitingly, there's a lot of collaboration happening. You know, we've gotten to a point now where we realize that, you know, strength comes as a collective, not as an individual. You know, to see these catchment-wide projects, you know, multi-stakeholder groups emerging all over the place, it's really exciting. You know, it's really exciting. And my hope is we can get to a place where 100-year plans become the norm, you know. Instead of having three-year plans, we actually have 100, 200, 300, 400-year plans. That's the mindset we need to be thinking in, I think. But that would be awesome. Hopefully we can take the funders along with us on that one. But
yeah. I don't think so. Might even relook at the funding model. I think that's awesome. So KEEP and Bay Conservation Alliance.
Bay Conservation Alliance. And also as well, just like to give a shout out for Tarnage Tree Trust as well. Absolutely phenomenal charitable trust that I'm lucky enough to be a trustee with. The amount of work they've done over the last 25, 30 years on encouraging the use of indigenous species for a variety of reasons, it's just been phenomenal. So if you hop on their website, whole heap of resources there. Everything from, you know, handbooks on revegetation, afforestation, all the way through to growing some indigenous species as a timber crop, as a commercial crop.
So Tane's Tree Trust have been providing a lot of the foundational knowledge, resources, scientific research, turning that into step-by-step playbooks and plans you can use to reforest your land to create this future. We need the scientific foundation, and that's a lot of what they're doing on a pragmatic basis, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And the strength with Tane's Tree Trust is that all their research is publicly available. You know, that's core to everything that they do. It's publicly available, so they don't guard the information. They don't get precious about IP. We learn something, we get it out there.
I love that. That's really awesome. This has been really insightful. We're chatting with you today, Wayne. I know we've had a lot of chats before this, but just getting your thoughts on how this all ties together from communities through to what a healthy forest looks like, through to the challenges that our browsers face, to how that's why communities are the solution and the types of indicator species like Kukaku we can look at. I really appreciate having you on.
It's been good chatting to you as well, man. Thank you for that.
Yeah, enjoy it. Cheers.